All right, so as I wrote this morning, I was listening recently to an interview with a friend of the show, you might say, a friend of the Sangha, Beth Upton, who is a lovely, interesting meditation teacher based in Spain right now. She was a nun at the Paok Monastery in Burma for like a dozen years, and a bunch of folks in our Sangha and fellow travelers have been studying with her lately. She's teaching, emphasizing very strong concentration practice, emphasizing jhana, doing very close individual guidance of students, and I think really doing beautiful work teaching kind of outside of the sort of mainstream Theravadan model in the lay West. And so she was being interviewed by someone, and she said, kind of offhandedly, they were talking about, you know, some of the criticisms that can come with Dharma teaching and some of the sort of the various dangers, and she said something like, you know, well, you know, the like the basic message of the Dharma is an offensive message, you know, And what I understand her to mean is that the core teaching on letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion, on really living in a material way in the world, not taking more than you need, being profoundly generous, cultivating the heart that that is really, you know, free from wanting, free from, you know, pushing and pulling at the world in a certain way, that this message is not just difficult to manifest or embody, which it is, but that in a way it's it offends the sensibilities, and that, you know, it goes so strongly against what the culture around us wants, but also just what the ego wants, and what our natural proclivities are. It goes against even, you know, some of the beautiful, like, humanistic virtues that we've come to think of as universal givens, you know, like human rights and justice and, you know, the what we think that humans deserve, you know, life, liberty, free speech, the pursuit of happiness, clean water, clean air. Like, all that stuff is good. Most of that stuff is good. But the Dharma it not only doesn't promise those things, but it actually actively reminds us that those things are unreliable, ephemeral, can't be trusted, can't be a source of reliable happiness. And I think particularly on the you know, politically oriented progressive, well, I'll just say the progressive left, because that's kind of my people broadly, but I think this is true in anywhere on the ideological spectrum. Let's say politically, the Dharma challenges any idea we have that a social or political or material stance and the actions that go with it can lead to ease and reliable happiness. And now I happen to believe that the political and material program on the left is far more conducive to ease and happiness for far more people than other political programs that are popular at the moment. And that's why I vote for who I vote for and encourage what I encourage. But I would be deluded to lose sight of the way that all of that good stuff is marked by emptiness. is marked by loss, is unreliable, is dukkha, ultimately. And this is the offensive message, you know. And the messages from psychology about healthy ego structure, which is a good thing to have, and, you know, healing, which is a good thing to experience and work on, those things can be healthy, and they can be good. They can be goods in the world. And the Dharma can still offend the sensibility when we believe in those things. But I think it comes down to a certain way, like the goodness of something like healing becomes not just a kind of temporal good, like it's good to be as healthy as we can given our conditions so that we can practice and you know, do good in the world, do what's helpful. But we forget that. It's almost like our instinct is to take something that is, in a certain way, a very simple or practical aspect of modern life, maintaining our health, or, you know, supporting social systems that are equitable or that support people, and instead of supporting them in a simple, kind of uncluttered in the heart way, we go too far with them, and we turn them into ideologies or movements, and even that's not a problem, right? Like, you have to have a movement of people if you want to get anything done in the world, and so it's not the turning something into a movement or even believing in it that's necessarily the problem. But for the Dharma practitioner who wants to be free, I think we have to do whatever we're doing, however we're engaging or participating. There's the imperative to remember clinging, to remember suffering. The way we were investigating last week when we were looking at the inquiry that says, what am I feeling right now? What's it rooted in? Where's the clinging? And can I feel the suffering that's there? If we do that, we could notice that even something that is absolutely worthy of support, you know, a concept like equity or justice or fairness or, you know, the health of our planet for future generations, like that these things are both, that they can be and they are both at the same time good and the cause of suffering. And so then the Dharma is this peace within culture. It doesn't have to be your whole culture. Like, the Dharma doesn't have to be your 24/7, you know, the only thing that you believe in. But as a part of what is inspiring in this life, the Dharma is the part that you know, follows you around, you know, like a nagging ghost in an ochre robe, you know, just a little bit over your left shoulder, every once in a while to say, you know, watch out, like, don't get too caught in this good thing. Don't lose your center. I mean, you know, the Dharma is offensive. It's an offensive message in the way that, you know, the fourth of the, you know, reminders, the daily reminders, after remembering old age, sickness, and death, and that we're still subject to them, is, you know, everything that is beloved to me, that is beloved to my heart, will be lost, will be separated from me. And so, you know, no tradition in the world, including the Dharma, would ever tell, you know, would ever tell us to not love our children or care for their well-being or want them to be well, or even be like attached to their well-being in a certain way. But of all the traditions, the Dharma is one that I think tries to say something that is difficult to say. And it tries to say that these things can be true at the same time, that we can love our children and or anything that is dear to us. And at the same time, we can cultivate the heart of letting go, that isn't just letting go of stress, but it's letting go of attachment in a way that that doesn't serve us, you know, no matter what it is. That if the heart is becoming constricted and bound in a certain way, that it doesn't serve well-being. So it offends the ego, it offends the sensibilities in that way. And the heart of the thing that offends, you know, is renunciation. It is the vision that the Buddha had, that when we live in a way where we're taking only what's needed and really the minimum needed, we're bringing the quality of generosity forward and really sharing it forward in a way, and we're saying something radical that exists in various ways in some places in the animal world and in some places not, right? So, you know, some species, only eat kind of a balanced amount of another species. But sometimes we think, oh, an ecosystem has gone off balance when, you know, maybe we, why is it always us? It's always us. We, decimate one species in a web, and because of the loss of that species, this species, you know, there becomes too many of these, and then this one falls off balance, or too many of these eat too many of these, and then these disappear. And there are all these ways that some animal species seem to know how to consume resources in a balanced way, and others really don't. And when given the opportunity, they will just keep going until a certain system is out of balance. For whatever reason, we are one of those species that has not figured out on scale how to take only what we need, to consume resources in a way that maintains the balance of the whole system. And this is our core defilement, I think. I think greed, hatred, delusion starts with greed for a reason. It's not greed in the way that we think of, like, you know, like a cartoon, like Moneybags villain, you know, cackling as he wins the Monopoly game, you know. Like, sure, there's that, like, down with those guys. But it's not actually that. It's that there's something in the psyche of our whole species for a while now, and it's not perhaps forever, because in so many of the indigenous cultures that we know of through preserved stories, there are all of these stories and myths that center around not taking too much. And, you know, when we hear about, you know, cultures, many of those who tended the lands that we're now on, who were here for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10,000 years before Europeans arrived. And nobody lives in a place for 10,000 years without living there in some form of balance. Ecosystems go out of balance quickly when more is taken in a way that sends them off. And so our species has known this, but for some time now, a subgroup of our species that has gotten very powerful and spread over the globe lost that ancient wisdom. And so then we are now, in many ways, the species that doesn't know how to do this basic Dharma virtue. So one way of understanding what the Buddha brings forward is that he understands the long arc of suffering through multiple lives, through karma, through how actions give rise to results and further actions, how intention gives rise to action, how greed gives rise to harm. And seeing this, his medicine, sometimes I think it's a medicine that restores, or not restores, because you can never go backwards, but that reinvents an aspect of indigeneity, one of the most important aspects of indigeneity, which was the quality of not taking more than you need. The wisdom of being able to, as a community, to not take more than you need. I think it's powerful that the Buddha started not an individual psychological movement, but a community of people, an intentional community of monastics and the lay people that supported them, that was founded upon the principle of sharing resources and not just sharing resources. So it wasn't just a lay community where everyone pooled resources. It wasn't just a pure sort of communal lay state, because he recognized that in the lay situation, lay here just means that your life includes raising children and having to assemble the resources to tend children, that a fully lay community would never really be able to make this radical shift of taking only what you need. And so in a way that I feel like I have an intuition toward, but that's hard to explain exactly why this would be the case, but it makes sense. He creates a celibate community that is like a celibate wing of his community. Remember, the community is everybody, the lay people and monastics. So he creates a celibate wing of the community where there's X number of people, and some portion of those people make enough resources to support everybody. And within that whole, there's a whole bunch of people, the monastics, who commit to taking only what they need in a very minimal way. One meal a day, only begged, never using money, never growing food, and not having children. And so just living that way, that will radically reduce your footprint, as it were, to use modern language. But it'll also make it possible for that small number of lay people to support this huge number of people, very differently than if it was lay people supporting a huge number of children. And of course, taking that many people out of the childbearing population also keeps the general population down. So you have this intentional community where a whole bunch of folks are celibate and practice a kind of intentional poverty, right? Living with the bare minimum needed for life. And then within that, their practice is to actualize that virtue of simplicity, not just externally in the material, but internally, by taking on as little, conceptually, you might say, as needed to maintain life. So in the way that the monastics take very little material out of the general community, they don't take in the stories and narratives and concepts from the general culture that lead to more greed and hatred and delusion. Right? So they clear the heart from, you know, excess consumed content. What if that's a way we could think about meditation? That it's like going on a mental diet, you know, in a certain way, in service of not contributing to like the resource pollution of our planet. So like to not contribute to, you know, the like content overload that is the current internet, you know, which I understand is something like 90% pornography. So then to not particularly consume that resource and to not give rise to the seeds of you know, suffering that lead one to consume, you know, to like participate in that economy, let's say, is a kind of taking only what you need, you know. What if celibacy is a certain way of saying, you know, move erotic energy only the amount needed for well-being? And then, you know, the idea is like, well, that's actually fairly simple to do. Like, doesn't even really take another person. I don't know how far that metaphor, that comparison really works. But I have the sense, I want to propose the sense that this thing that is, you know, the offensive message of the Dharma is actually that this core concept of a kind of radical simplicity of means, that this is at the heart of every aspect of the Dhamma, that all of the teachings will come down to a sort of like, make it really simple, and then it actually turns out to be quite simple to be a human being. You know, relationships get simpler if you're not lying and cheating and stealing. Relationships get simpler if you're not caught up in sexual energy with people in the way that you might be if you didn't have any training around how to deal with desire and wanting and speech and you know, relationships. Renunciation offends the modern sensibility, I think partly because, not just because it's difficult, but because there have now, you know, particularly since the waning of some of the great repressive religions, let's say, I'll stick to the sort of secular left for the moment, because of course I'm not even sure the great repressive religions are waning. There's hella repressive folks all over the place doing their religion very fully, but let's say there's in the communities where Buddhism is growing in, you know, the States, for instance, it's a more and more secular community, and it's a more and more, you know, socially liberal and progressive community where there's a lot less, you know, shaming and restrictions around social behavior. So, you know, in my social world here in the Bay Area, a whole lot of people are polyamorous, having multiple lovers, multiple partners. There's not a lot of shame for one's sexuality around. There hasn't been shame around, you know, greed and excessive, you know, materialism for a very long time. Generally, you'll get shamed for it a little bit on the hippie left, but, you know, more or less, there's a very strong, like, hedonistic trend in the culture that says that all this stuff that renunciation, you know, pulls one against, like desire, is actually totally healthy. And you know, I'm enough a part of that culture that I feel like I'm obliged to say, because it's been true in my experience, that some amount of that is healthy. And maybe a huge amount of it is healthy. I think part of what's offensive about the Dharma is that healthy doesn't mean free from suffering. Healthy doesn't mean free from attachment or the potential of dukkha. And so we have this difficult proposal from the Dhamma that there are things that are beautiful and healthy and good, and some things that are not beautiful and not healthy and not good that we still desire, but that all of it can be a source of dukkha, of suffering, when held unskillfully. And letting go, it, right, is already not easy, but it's made even more difficult when some part of us doesn't believe that we really should or need to let go. And I think this is a particular challenge in some of the communities that hear the message of the Dhamma right now. If you've really come to believe that there's nothing really wrong with wealth, let's say, you know, there's some way that, like, the old Christian virtues of charity and humility and, you know, modesty and, are just not popular anymore. And, like, for some really good reasons, because those things really messed some people up the way they were taught. But it might be easy to come to a belief then that a certain amount of, you know, pride and lustiness and vulgarity and bigness of, you know, consumption in various ways is actually totally fine, and may even be part of your liberation, you know, from capitalist patriarchy and all the things. And that might be true, right? Those things can totally be true. And it's going to be hard to embrace a kind of radical simplicity if some part of us also believes that that radical simplicity is, you know, either complicit in my old suffering, like it's just the voice of patriarchy coming back trying to squash my bigness, you know, my beauty, or that it's just not necessary anymore. I think there's a strong message that renunciation is like you just don't need to do it, you know, that liberation can be found within all the excesses. This is why Tantra, why misappropriated Tantra is tremendously popular in the hedonistic Bay Area, the hedonistic West Coast, let's say, but lots of places in the world. Because it's a marvelous message that you should be able to have everything you want and still be free. And again, I suppose this is my punchline tonight. It's not that that's not true, but it's very difficult because the force of grasping, the forces of greed are so strong and they can delude us. And so the thing that gets in the way of practice then is doubt. You know, that I want to live a really simple life, but why am I forbidding myself something that you know other teachers are telling me is totally healthy? And it's hard to figure out what should I do? What's actually healthy? You know, and what's a toxic message from, you know, an ancient patriarchy or a new one that wants to clamp down on my well-being. And so, you know, I think I'm totally doing both sides-ist kind of teaching tonight. And some of this reveals a way that that where I sit in this myself changes over time. Like sometimes I can really feel the emptiness of some of the messages, like say the hedonistic messages that are around. And other times I can really see how helpful they are for some folks and how they've been helpful for me at different times. And so, you know, mostly I think it's really going to land in a kind of maybe more than was needed for some folks in ancient times, and maybe not. Like maybe they were just as complicated as us, but I don't know them. I suspect that's really true, but that like it's never possible to just come up with a, you know, one size fits all rule for renunciation that I should follow, even for myself. Like, oh, I will now only do this, you know. I will now never eat sugar because, you know, but then to say like, there's a certain amount of discernment that we always have to use, and it may well be true that like, never eating sugar again would be tremendously helpful, you know, and any time that the voice comes in that says, you know, like, something about how you know, like becoming too rigid is also a kind of grasping, and that there's a certain sort of eros of celebration that just includes a variety of foods, some of which contain, you know, sugar in them, and that, you know, like I could come up with that because that's what the voice has said. You know, when is that voice doubt and it's a hindrance? And when is it a kind of wisdom of participating in the world? And you have to figure that out for yourself. And we have to figure it out in all of the gnarliest places. We have to figure it out around how we deal with sexuality, how we deal with money and material resources, what we do with food and all of those things. And so I was going to talk about like, okay, well, then what are some of the sort of prerequisites and the preliminaries for doing this well? And I'm not going to say more about that right now. But here's one where I'll go against the traditional wisdom and maybe this is a cleaner than money and sex and food. This is a really simple version of this binary. The Buddha regularly teaches that it's healthy not to sleep too much. And throughout the monastic system, there's an exhortation to sleep as little as needed, really. Like you could take this same teaching on taking only what you need into the realm of like how much sleep to get. And, you know, so hold that in one hand and maybe your left hand, I don't know. And in the other hand, hold, you know, the contemporary teaching that most of us are underslept in a way that causes tremendous stress, that the symptoms of sleep deprivation are identical to the symptoms of ADHD, that a lot of undiagnosed or diagnosed ADHD is probably just sleep deprivation. That, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Sleep is healthy. And so that's one of them that I will tend to say, whatever for the old texts, fix your sleep. Like, make sure you're getting good, deep, and enough sleep. Deep sleep, solid sleep, nourishing sleep. And if there's any like tweaks to be made and anything to figure out about when you take your caffeine or when you get off your screen or how late you stay up because you, I don't know, because your meditation teacher only Zooms at a certain hour and it's 11 p.m. for you because you live in a different time zone. You know, sorry, East Coasters, I love you. But that there's something so helpful about balancing our energetic system in a way that creates well-being. And for me, that starts, you know, that starts with sleep and exercise and food. So I'll pause there. That was really just a tiny postscript, the bit about sleep. But I'll pause there with this sort of brief bit about the offensive message and the difficulty of renunciation and how deeply doubt can confuse us, really, because we're actually getting quite contradictory messages about what's good to cultivate. And it's confusing for a good reason, because actually both messages are often right. They're just coming from a really different worldview. And so how we practice with that is really a dance, and it requires discernment and creativity. And the ability to sometimes, even as an experiment, just say no to something that where doing so would make the whole system simpler or calmer, less stimulated, even if that stimulation is otherwise healthy or praised by the culture around us. All right, so pausing there. Thank you for entertaining the offensive message of the Dhamma, and to Beth for saying the phrase to start the whole thing off.